AI is obviously the dominant topic in tech lately. And I think occasionally there's AI that's nonsense and occasionally there's AI that's great. You know, I love finding new proteins for medicine and so on. What I meant when I said there is no AI is that I don't think we serve ourselves well when we put our own technology up on a pedestal as if it were a new god that we created. I think we're really getting a little too full of ourselves to think well when we do that. I think we confuse ourselves too easily. This goes back to Alan Turing, the main founder of computer science, who had this idea of the Turing test. In the test, you can't tell whether the computer has gotten more human-like or the human has gotten more computer-like. Because people are very prone to becoming more computer-like. Like when we're on social media, we let ourselves be guided by the algorithms so that we start to become dumb like the algorithms want us to. And you see that all the time. It's really degraded our psychologies and our society.
Jaron Lanier is a pioneering technologist, writer, and musician, best known for coining the term virtual reality and founding VPL Research, the first company to sell VR products. He led early breakthroughs in virtual worlds, avatars, and VR applications in fields like surgery and media. Lanier writes on philosophy and the economics of technology in best-selling books Who Owns the Future? And You Are Not a Gadget. His book, Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality, is an inventive blend of autobiography, science writing, and philosophy. Lanier has been named one of Time 100's most influential people and serves as prime unifying scientist at Microsoft's Office of the CTO. As a musician, he's performed with Sarah Bareilles, Philip Glass, T-Bone Burnett, Laurie Anderson, John Baptiste, and others. Jaron Lanier, welcome to The Creative Process.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So it's hard to know where to begin because you've led such an interesting life and I've enjoyed all your books. You Are Not a Gadget was the first one I read, and you've always argued for the importance of humanism and putting humanity at the center of technology. Perhaps we should begin with your memoir, Dawn of the New Everything. So this book brings together some of those different elements of what you do. It helped me understand VR, virtual reality, a bit more. But for you, I think it seems to be more expansive than a scientific or a technological pursuit. It's almost like the core of human intellectual activity. It's kind of a web of life, a language for connections.
Oh, gosh. Well, virtual reality has meant very different things to me. You know, I've been working on it, God, for a half a century now, which is sort of hard to believe. And I had my first startup selling it. Is it 40 years ago? Yeah, it's 40 years ago. So it hasn't been the same. Originally, when I was young, what I was going for was a kind of new layer of human experience that would be a little bit like shared intentional dreaming, where people would be able to spontaneously improvise what's going on in virtual reality for each other. And the image I had of it back then would be that you'd play virtual musical instruments, like some crazy instruments like I love, and play the world into existence. And the idea was sometimes called post-symbolic communication, which meant if you could find a way to directly bring the stuff in virtual reality and the principles in virtual reality into existence in an improvised way that was social, it would be a kind of communication that transcends symbols, where we use the little things we can do directly in the world, like move our tongues around, to symbolize all the things we can't change in the world. You can't spontaneously create a giant flying glittering elephant in front of you or something, but you can speak those words. And so the idea was to find a way to make that thing appear for other people directly. So that was back then. And it's gone through many iterations since then. And of course, a huge difference now is that there are millions of people who use virtual reality. Back when I started, there was no one. And then there were two, and then there were four. And for a long time, there were really only a handful. In fact, in the old days, even if I gave somebody a demo, they still couldn't understand what they had just experienced. It was so exotic and so strange. But now it's become ordinary. It's become commodified. And the version of virtual reality as it's appeared is very different from what I imagined. It's much more, how would I put it? Driven by the economics of the attention economy, of trying to get people sort of hooked on things. It's much more cliche. Like, I'm really amazed at how much virtual reality content looks like other virtual reality content. There's really not a lot of variety. There's a little sometimes. It's also kind of not as successful as I had thought it would be by now. And of course, I imagine the reason it's not successful is that people are doing it wrong. You know, of course, I would think that. The economics of it tend to draw upon the economics of cinema or games. And I think they're both very different and neither of those models work at all. What there should be is something a little bit more like a continuous membership model. There's one I helped start called Second Life a long time ago that in a way is closer to what I think ought to happen, except of course Second Life was really more for PC screens that didn't really make it into the phone era, much less the headset era. I'm really surprised at how poor social VR is. I mean, the term virtual reality, the reality in there was supposed to mean social. That was the original intent of the term. I still like the stuff. I still enjoy putting on a headset, you know, and I think some of them have gotten good in some ways. The styles of interaction that are available are kind of inferior to what we could do in the 80s, because in the 80s, the graphics were so bad that we had to really focus on haptics and on sound. And so those were done pretty well. And now the graphics are both cheap and higher quality. And in a way, people have gotten lazy, I think, about interaction. A lot of the interactions are, I think, really uninteresting. I mean, I think the most interesting thing about virtual reality is being in there with your body and really moving. And we used to do it with clothing, with instrumented gloves and things like that. And now, of course, it's done with cameras and other kinds of sensors. And I'm surprised how little has been done. Like, for instance, in the 80s, I made a virtual saxophone where you could play the keys and your fingers still wouldn't interpenetrate. And there was just a lot of detail and many other things like that. And you still can't get that level of hand interaction on the Meta headsets that I've seen, or the Apple one, or really anybody's. And it's peculiar. It's sort of like the community, to me, feels lazy. But that's, once again, I'm the old fart. I should think that way. That's my job.
Well, I'm sure there are those who have approached you to be a brain trust, to put your brain in a jar. If we had your brain and your imagination, I think it could also be, of course, there's these interfaces. Mm-hmm. An artist talking about, I don't understand this stuff. But you also need, I think, the players who have that imagination, that eccentricity, and who can improvise. Because a lot of people can improvise it on. I know that you can. I was just listening to one of your performances, Captured Live. So for me, as a painter and writer, is that I feel like I have a pretty vivid dream life. So I kind of think that that is my VR, although it's not social, but it feels social. There's a whole community in here, and sometimes it's too much. I have to wake up to get a rest. So it's kind of like, I think for artists, we have our own virtuality. It's like you make music and it's like, oh, you can do that in the experiential world. And then for others, I think it could be a great way to free up your body and imagination. And it's kind of like, could I get an interface that would communicate right with my brain that my dreams already do, right?
Well, this question of how to spontaneously cause interesting things to come into existence, I still like the idea of doing it with virtual musical instruments. And I think that should be feasible. But of course, the thing that we've developed in recent years is prompting, using text to create things. And so we do that, of course, famously with movies and whatnot, where you can ask for something and then a diffusion model in AI will attempt to create the thing you want. And there are many, many available models now, and many people who 4 or 5 years ago, we started to do a similar model for virtual reality stuff. And that project was called Speaking the World into Existence. And then the social one was called Social Conjuring. And I mostly did that with graduate student research interns as projects in the Microsoft research world. And it was fun. You know, it was cool. You could ask for stuff and it would come up. And more recently, that kind of thing has become more commonplace, kind of as a developer tool for gaming to help developers make games more quickly. But to me, it's just so much more interesting to do it in real time while you're in a world. And that side of things hasn't happened as much, although I think people would really like it once they have a chance to experience it.
Yeah.
Being able to socially make up stuff and have other people experience when they make up stuff and you collaborate and just building this world around you is a wonderful thing. It's similar to a lot of ancient storytelling and mythologies and whatnot. And I hope it happens. I just think people will really like it.
Yeah, I think it could be liberating. I think it could be utopian. I do want to go into the dawn of the new everything, the part that's about your life, because I don't want to say eccentric, but it's just so varied. I mean, there's just so many events in your life where your imagination was liberated in a way. It's a kind of education that a lot of us don't get a chance. Like, you seem like you're forever learning an autodidactic existence, you know, whatever you want to learn about. But just tell us about how that curiosity developed and a very unusual, unique life journey.
Sure. I've been asked variations of this question before, and I have difficulty knowing what to say, because the first thing is I'm a little suspicious of the doctrine of the special person, where like this one is really creative compared to that one. That I'm unusual, I think, is probably true. I'm a little hesitant to buy into a claim that I'm more whatever than somebody else. This is a thing that we tend to do. We tend to say, oh, this person's exceptionally brilliant and this one's exceptionally creative. And I mean, maybe, but on the other hand, I think we sometimes miss those things in people that we treat as being more ordinary. And then the other thing is, like, I don't know how much insight we really have into ourselves. I think in my case, I had parents who were somewhat similar, but then I lost my mom very early on in a way that was the trauma of my life and continues to be in a way. And it does come out of trauma. I think what knocks us off course is often not some really positive and pleasant thing. So it's possible that there's this sort of spirit in which a question like that can be asked, which is like, well, why can't you give us insight that will help everybody to be like you? And my initial thought is, God, I wouldn't wish that on people. A lot of eccentricity is probably a response to trauma in many cases. So we have enough trauma in the world as it is. I mean, it's not the only response. Sometimes people become more conformist in response to trauma too. They seek more safety, perhaps.
So for those who don't know, your parents were Holocaust survivors.
Yeah. Only my mother. Most of my father's family was wiped out by a different process called the pogroms, in which mobs would attack Jewish villages in parts of Eastern Europe and just kill everybody. And so one of my relatives was mute her whole life because she was the only family member who survived by staying absolutely silent behind her sister when her sister was killed by sword under a bed during a pogrom, and no other family member survived. So it wasn't just the Holocaust. There was a whole other thing going on. So in my father's case, it was pogroms. In my mother's case, it was a concentration camp.
So it's this kind of resilience that gets, because often the survivors of trauma don't talk about it, but it's like they know that they can survive. There's just an extra steel in the spirit. And I think that you're absolutely right. People do, when they come through trauma, even if you look at non-human animals, it's about a fight for survival and can do amazing things. It's in the name of survival, right? Something else is summoned in you and you don't know why. And the imagination must be an answer to that. It's like, how can we make beauty out of everything else planted in the soil?
I think that's got to be true. And the world at the moment is particularly unpredictable. And I deeply hope we're not hurtling into some other source of trauma for many people. We're already there, but it has potential to be much worse. So I'm on edge lately, I have to say.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are living in these most interesting times that I wouldn't wish on other people. But, you know, in your childhood, as I understand, you were growing up, you went to school in Mexico, you grew up around New Mexico near the white sands. I mean, I'm just imagining this visual landscape. You're going across the border into Mexico for part of your schooling, coming back into America. It's like already this spirit, like pioneering or freedom, or it's like the limitations, I think, might think the lid is taken off of your imagination. And then afterwards, you talk about your mother. Then I believe there was a house fire. And then you later lived in a tent with your dad.
Yeah, that's true. These days, that would be called being homeless or unhoused or something. In those days, it was just being poor. But yeah, I did live in tents for a while with my dad.
And then what a wonderful dad that he allowed you permission while you're living in tents to build this geodesic dome. So it's like, that's an opportunity. He's not saying, oh, now we're homeless. This is an opportunity for growth or to exercise your imagination.
Yeah, we gradually built a house that he let me design when I was quite young. It took like 7 years to build. It was a crazy science fiction sort of spaceship of a house with elements of hippie geodesic domes, but also all kinds of other shapes. And it was great. It wasn't that well engineered. It's mostly collapsed. It makes for very interesting ruin these days.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful thing to know that you can restart. Yeah, I know. It's not perfect. But then it makes me think, you were for Microsoft. So you know that these billionaires and people who have enormous wealth over time, it takes sometimes towards the end of their life to realize that wealth is not money. Wealth is freedom in some ways. Wealth is an ability to do things with your time and not have your time be owned by people. It's that agent and autonomy. And so it seems like you had that from a very young age. And then you go back to New York, you were born there. And then you get into this whole avant-garde music scene with Laurie Anderson, and you're making zines and you're funded by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And that's another twist.
Yeah, I've always been in music, and within that, one part's been in kind of the avant-garde scene, maybe a little less so lately, but I loved it. Like in the 70s, I loved that crazy world, and I still keep up with the people who are still alive from that time.
70s?
My first stint in New York in the music scene was in the late 70s when I was a teenager, and it was fun. I really liked it. I liked hanging out with people like John Cage and running around and doing crazy shows and stuff. It was great.
So on the one hand, you have this very living, ephemeral art, and you marry that, then you have one foot in technology. And yet I feel like for people who don't know, Jaron has this amazing collection of really ancient instruments that create these, I think, conversations with history boundaries in different cultures and countries. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot, and I guess there still must be so much mystery in music for you. I mean, what do you get from it? And you also improvise as well, which is another thing that live on stage, mm-hmm. a lot of people would not know how to do.
Yeah, what is it with the instruments? I mean, I do have this kind of obsessive thing about finding and learning new obscure musical instruments. And in fact, one of my problems in life is I've kind of run out. I have at this point possibly a comprehensive tour of the instruments, you know, or close to it. So it's getting harder and harder to find new adventures. But at any rate, it started, my mom had taught me music. And when she died, somehow I just became obsessed with learning new instruments because I remember that experience of her teaching me piano. And of course, I still play the piano, but I also just crave that experience of learning new instruments, which is sort of a connection to her, I suppose. So that's probably the best explanation. But then there's a lot more. I mean, I always think of instruments as some of the most optimistic signals for human nature that we find in history, because there's a cliche that it's the weapons of war that drive technology. And of course, that's true in many cases, but it's also true in many cases that it's musical instruments that drive technology. The musical bow logically had to precede the bow and arrow, and casting bells preceded casting cannons and guns. And the first product sold by Silicon Valley Company was Hewlett-Packard's music synthesizer for Walt Disney for the movie Fantasia. Those are some of the examples I like. But at any rate, the point is that we find in musical instruments this incredible drive for technological innovation. And it's a particular kind of innovation that I like, where the point of an instrument has from time to time, sometimes it's meant to be louder than previous ones or something like that. Sometimes there's just a parameter you're pushing. But there's this other thing about instruments where they have to be eloquent. You have to be able to pick them up and really work with them. And so there's this user interface quality drive that's ancient, that is part of instruments. And I just love that aspect of them. And that should be true for all technologies, but it isn't necessarily so. And then they're just amazing. I mean, you look at them as objects and they're amazing. They are the haptic art form. They're incredible haptic devices to interact with, to blow in, to touch. They're visually amazing. And they are such an accumulation of history of each culture they come from. And the material culture of any particular place is probably most beautifully reflected in their instruments, because the instrument has to have everything. It has to have the function and the beauty and the cultural resonance all at once.
Yeah. And I think for me too, is that they say that now with AI that we might be able to decipher the language of non-human animals. But I think that the other way that we can communicate with animals is music, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. touch if they trust us, but that, and it's kind of amazing to see you can play music and then a bird will come by, or like a goat, you know, an elephant comes yeah. by. How moving is that?
I had a squirrel that would come around and knock in time to my piano practice. And at first I thought it was a coincidence, but then it just happened repeatedly and I had people come to witness it. So yeah, there are all kinds of odd little interspecies interactions that happen with music. Absolutely. It's one of the most wonderful things.
Yeah, that's what I feel like we can learn from it, because obviously it's naturally harmonizing. Mm-hmm. Logic, I mean, I don't know what came first, but I feel like they say with the heartbeat came first. We have this sonic world and a sonic landscape, and then we put sense onto it. But that was later, I think. So you've also been, it's so interesting because you've said some things that have been provocative for people or eye-opening for people, like Who Owns the Future is an older book, but you wrote a piece not too long ago in The New Yorker about there is no AI, because we're now, a lot of people are subscribing, it has consciousness. Isn't this amazing? All this stuff that's coming out of it. And you said, no, it's mm-hmm. theft. You know, just about how to reorientate our thinking.
Well, AI is obviously the dominant topic in tech lately. And I think occasionally there's AI that's nonsense, and occasionally there's AI that's great. You know, I love finding new proteins for medicine and so on. It's great. There's a lot of really wonderful stuff in AI. What I meant when I said there is no AI is that I don't think we serve ourselves well when we put our own technology up on a pedestal as if it were a new god that we created. I think we're really getting a little too full of ourselves to think well when we do that. I think we confuse ourselves too easily. This goes back to Alan Turing, the main founder of computer science, who had this idea of the Turing test, which is, it's really hard to make some kind of a meter for what a human is. You don't have like a consciousness meter or something. And so if an AI can fool a person, we should treat that as being as good a confirmation as we'll get. We should treat it as real. So he imagined this test where there'd be a person and an AI competing to be treated as real, and then a judge. And what I would say is, in the test, you can't tell whether the computer has gotten more human-like or the human has gotten more computer-like, because people are very prone to becoming more computer-like. Like when we're on social media, we let ourselves be guided by the algorithms so that we start to become dumb like the algorithms want us to. And you see that all the time. It's really degraded our psychologies and our society. So in the Turing test, there's a 2/3 chance that what's happening is the person's getting dumber instead of the computer getting smarter, because there's two people to get dumb, but only one computer to get smart. So this is to say that there's no hard and fast rule. I think, you know, all kinds of things happen, and some people have wonderful experiences with social media, and some people probably have good experiences falling in love with a fake AI person or whatever it might be. But 2/3 of the time, it'll make people worse. I think that's a good rule of thumb. So like what I was putting out is that since we don't really know what's going on with a big AI system that can fool us, when you really don't know something and there's a philosophical mystery, instead of just making an assumption that benefits what a tech company might benefit from, because believe me, every time somebody believes in AI, I get to buy another instrument. Like I'm a direct beneficiary of the madness. I really am. But there's this alternative, which is you could say AI systems are actually new forms of collaboration between people. People wrote the code, people contributed the training data, people managed the system, and the whole thing is a big human collaboration, and the only thing real there is the people. That's a totally valid way to interpret what's going on. There's no need to interpret this new entity on the scene, which is AI. Instead, you can see it as being like a more elaborate version of the Wikipedia, of people cooperating together to create this resource. And I just think if you think of it that way, your head gets clearer, it becomes easier to design beneficial applications, it gets easier to make the systems better. It actually improves the technology if you think that way. So I just think it's smarter to think there's no AI. There's no absolute truth. You can interpret there being an AI if you want, but I just think you'll do better if you think there isn't one.
I just think of it as an advanced search that also makes errors, and it's a kind of authorized theft or plagiarism machine. And so for myself, I have to, like, I think any artist use it ethically, because we know it's drawing all these other people whose value has been kind of sidestream. Their knowledge has just fed it. So I don't put stuff into it that's my original creativity. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure we know everyone's been scraped, but like I don't intentionally. Well,
whether it's a plagiarism machine or not depends on how it's used. Yeah. I mean, it's totally plausible to use it in a way that is not a plagiarism machine by rewarding and celebrating and even paying the people who provided the most indispensable training data to it. So the plagiarism is not part of the AI algorithm. It's part of the societal framing of the AI algorithm. And it's very important to understand that and to understand how that could change without reducing any benefits that there might be. I think the Wikipedia set us on a bad path, because the Wikipedia, in a way, and it even goes further back, even search was trying to simulate an AI. Like Yahoo was like yet another hallowed oracle. The idea was that there'd be this oracle. And so by erasing the people, you'd create this illusion of this new entity. And then the Wikipedia continued that illusion with the emphasis on pseudonyms. And at least pseudonyms are something. So there's a bit of continuity, but I would have preferred to see a tendency towards true names in the Wikipedia, not a requirement. There are reasons for some people not to do it, but I think this default to pseudonyms did tend to create this illusion of the one true rendering of truth, which is not necessarily great. And then with AI, we've pushed that even further of just erasing people. But we don't have to erase people to get whatever benefits you might seek from the types of large models that we're building now.
Yeah. And you've, of course, written about that and Who Owns the Future. You're an advocate for data unions and other ways mm-hmm. just compensating. And it's not just artists. It's all those people who have been scraped.
Yeah. And I should point out for those who are wondering, well, what's he doing at Microsoft? I think this is a win-win idea. I think that when we elevate society, we elevate all the parts of society, including even the tech companies. So I think those who think that there's this inherent opposition between tech companies and people who provide data out there, I think they're just wrong. I think that's just a logical error and they're making a mistake.
Yeah, because it's based, as you've written extensively about, on this free model, which is nice and utopian if people don't have enough money, yes. But then the quality does go down. You talk about having a subscription model or membership. It really increases the quality. I mean, look what's happened to journalism, where the lies are free, but the truth is behind, as they say, a paywall. So
yeah, this is, I mean, to me, a really interesting test bed for this economics of creativity is YouTube, where YouTube, after considerable advocacy and pressure over the years, has allowed for more diverse ways for YouTubers to make a living, where some of them find different sorts of sponsorship deals or sell merch or their Patreon sites or whatever it is. And that way they've been able to mix and match to find something that works for them. And the interesting thing is that as that's happened, the peak of quality in YouTube has gone way up. So you can see content now from YouTubers that's really superlative, in my opinion. Like some of the science bloggers are incredible. incredible. And some of the music bloggers are incredible. But then you've also seen this trough where the worst stuff gets worse and worse. And there's this peculiar, I call this the life of the parody, this idea that in digital systems, like the bit can be set to 1 or 0 and it's the same. Like in the YouTube world, you can do well by getting as bad as possible and debasing yourself as much as possible, just as easily as you can by becoming as good as possible. So you have these weird polar extremes that both grow. And on the bad side, misinformation and stupid addictive content and content that makes people feel terrible and spreads lies of one sort or another, all that stuff also becomes more and more viral and also becomes more and more powerful. And I think the only way to get out of the life of the parody, the only way to get back to a grounded way of telling good stuff from bad stuff is to reconnect it to real humans a little bit more and a real human economy. But I mean, we know that the internet is capable of generating wonderful material. It's just that we have to find a way for that to be preferred in a pure attention contest. Bad stuff and good stuff kind of equals. The attention economy doesn't care. So one of the proposals, if you go to The Atlantic magazine, I wrote a piece called How to Fix Twitter and All of Social Media, obviously before it turned into X. And it describes a strategy where instead of people posting as individuals, they turn into groups. They become like bands or little journals or something. So they'd suddenly have an incentive to keep each other from being so terrible. And also they could share the duty so they don't have to be on the hamster wheel constantly to keep up attention. And I believe that that kind of transformation is the thing that needs to happen, not some kind of top-down censorship or some sort of AI that supposedly can tell what's quality. I think we need to just restructure things in a way that people will tend to want to keep each other from becoming terrible. And that's one idea that I think would work.
I'm Jamie Lambers, and I've been seriously watching YouTube for over 10 years. I loved Jaren's perspective on how YouTube has changed over the years, especially how recently the quality of YouTube either reaches an all-time peak or an all-time low. Throughout the past over a decade that I've been watching YouTube, I have seen various controversies and various rises in popularity. I've seen incredible YouTube videos from all angles. Science videos, music videos, history videos, movie videos, gaming videos, original writing and ideas, even content that has broken into the mainstream and has proven that digital media is now a genuine competitor for mainstream television. Throughout that time, I've also seen incredibly strange happenings, some very bizarre controversies, videos made explicitly to shock people, heavy criticisms aimed directly at YouTube's policies for kids, videos that are barely edited, not human created, stolen from other creators, or just complete clickbait. I love hearing Jaren's perspective about how YouTube has developed over the last 20 years of its existence, particularly over the last decade. Frankly, as a frequent YouTube viewer, I've experienced it myself for years. So it was really cool for me to hear someone directly involved in the tech industry talk about YouTube's development over the years. And now, back to the interview.
Yeah, and on the globe, we talk about domination, and of course, America, and of course, China now too, and there are these competing models. When we talk now about AI, which is seen as the new gold rush, and of course, I'm talking to you from Europe, and we have concerns because we didn't own any of the big search companies, and it's really, you talked about misinformation, creating these biases, there's a cultural domination. So I don't know if you want to go into issues of governance, but it's important to know who's sending you the information that you're receiving as fact.
Well, okay, I got to say a couple of harsh things to my European friends. European tech culture played a critical role in making everything get bad on the internet. And what happened was early in this century, the pirate parties and similar things largely came out of Europe and through the back door were often sponsored by companies like Google in particular. And the idea was everything should be free. This was based on a fundamental misunderstanding. In a big digital network, there's network effects that'll create these super hubs, these super central things. So if you make everything free, you disempower all of the little people, and instead everything goes to the center. And so you create these giant monopolies, which as it happens were American, not European. But had it not been for the intense European focus on a mistaken idea of what internet freedom should be all about with the pirate parties and so forth, I think we would have had a better chance of avoiding things getting as stupid as they have been. So I gotta say that. I gotta be honest with you.
Well, thank you for opening my eyes to that, because I'm glad they're getting their act together with the EU AI Act. I don't know how efficient that that is. But so I noticed on another note, I was reading that Mark Zuckerberg is predicting that smartphones, their reign is coming to an end, and he's predicting that smart glasses will take over as our main connection to the digital world. I don't know if this is something, because it seems similar to VR, but this is a different augmented reality. I mean, what are your views on
that? Yeah, the terminology gets a bit confusing. Back in the old days, meaning going to the late 70s, I guess, virtual reality was a social version of a virtual world. The virtual world was coined by an art theorist named Suzanne Langer in the 50s as an idea. And then Ivan Sutherland, the father of computer graphics, adopted it. And virtual reality was supposed to be the social version of that. And mixed reality was the thing that we kind of call augmented these days. I don't know, but the terms are all over the place and everybody wants to be able to get to coin the new term, I've noticed. So as far as like wearing goggles all the time, I don't know. I've always thought it was dumb. Like from when I was young, I always thought that the most special moment with virtual reality or anything similar was when you take them off, because then you see the world with fresh eyes. That moment of coming out is what's so magical. It's like sometimes if you see a really good movie and there's that moment when you leave the theater and you have altered perception for a moment, like that actually is the best part of the movie, isn't it? And I've always thought that this notion of just being in VR all the time would just make it boring and ordinary and miss the point and ruin it. You know, I think it's just a poorly informed idea. It's not based on a lot of experience with it, perhaps. I don't know. Obviously, if you have a company that's selling headsets, you'd want to promote that idea because then you sell more headsets. I mean, sure. And everybody wants the next iPhone. Everybody would like to be able to sell the ubiquitous device. Of course, of course, of course, of course. Look what that did for Apple, right? It's huge. So my own sense is, like, the usual reason people give for why it might not work is that people don't like how they look with glasses on. I don't think that's it exactly, because that's very subjective and people's subjective sense of what's attractive can shift from generation to generation and who knows. But I just think this idea of making something special into something ordinary is what'll turn people off. I don't know, like there's the occasional chocoholic that's just nibbling on chocolate all day long, but it's much more common for them to have punctuated equilibrium in their chocolate so they enjoy it when it comes up or something. I don't know. I just think people will naturally gravitate to want virtual reality to be special instead of ordinary.
Yeah, it's that dessert.
But I don't know, like the kids, who knows what they'll want? They're weird.
It would be like dreaming all the time, I think. Constant 24-hour dreaming, I could not deal with it. Jamie, are you going to come?
Hi, it's been great to hear your thoughts on all this stuff. Yeah, I've been really interested throughout this interview about you talking about the intersection of compensating artists and people who provide all the data to tech companies and individuals and the people on YouTube, especially who create better content, but there's also the people who create content for the sake of content and just get it out there and it becomes worse and worse. There's something that I'm just interested in about your perspective of, particularly as AI generated content becomes more prevalent online, as more of this shock content or just half worked on content, this lazy content really just keeps coming back out. Is there a way that you think the system can kind of work more in regards to fairly compensating the people who are actually working on the content and kind of bank down the content that is not being received very well, or is there simply for shock value, or is not made by people?
Sure. Okay, so look, right now, most AI services by far do not trace the human origins of the data that they're relying on the most to generate what you see or what you read from moment to moment. Could it be done technically? I think so. I'm certainly working on that. There is a small world of researchers who study that question and are trying to figure it out, and we know a fair amount about it. I don't want to pretend that all the problems are solved and we know everything about how to do it, but certainly working on it, and I believe it can be done. The one thing I think I should say at this juncture is that their motivations to do it, aside from a sense of societal quality and promoting human values and fairness and such things, there's also a sort of a short-term or sort of more immediate motivation, which has to do with safety and quality. So I want to explain that because I think it's often underemphasized. Right now, there are techniques like indirect prompt injection is a famous one, where you can trick an AI system into giving you content that we prefer you not get. For instance, can you take a picture of a kitchen and say, tell me how I can make a bomb from the available things you see in this? All right. So that's like a big no-no. And that's the kind of thing that responsible AI systems flag. I don't know how many of them are responsible in that way. I think there are more and more of them that maybe are not. But at any rate, if somebody's very clever about how they ask for that, it might not be apparent in the prompt or in the output that that's what's going on. For instance, they might ask for a cake recipe from available things, but as it would be done by some character who's a bomb maker in a movie, for instance, or something. something like that. They might find some Weasley way to get there. And then the output might come out, not making it obvious that it's a bomb. So how do you fix that? So in security, we have this idea called multi-factor authentication. So like when you try to log on to some site that has financial information, they'll also send a code to your phone, for instance. And the reason for that is that any kind of thing you can do directly on that one site, like a capture or something, a bad actor might be able to intercept. But as soon as there's multiple channels, it becomes that much harder for them. Not impossible, but you make life harder for them. So in the same way with AI, a lot of the ways that we try to make AI safer are by adding some twist to the AI itself, where there's some kind of guardrail. But if you have a whole other factor, then it makes it that much harder for weird, malicious, or accidental horrible things to happen. And going back to the human sources is a separate factor. If you say, well, what were the original sources relied upon to generate this output? If there's a bomb document in there, you got them, right? And indirect prompt injection is not going to hide that bomb document. And so I think it's important for us to understand that this idea of being human-centered makes the whole thing more reality-centered. It makes it all safer and better. It's a way of improving quality, and it's not just lofty utopian societal goals. And so I've been trying to emphasize that side of things more and more, because I think it's easier to make progress on that basis for now before we try to reinvent all of digital society.
And I think there's this fascinating idea behind dangerous information like that, that you can work your way around, but also dangerous misinformation, both from technology and from people in power or people you know. And so how do you hope, through the efforts that you're doing and other people are doing throughout the technology world and art world and all that, that we can kind of work to figure out what misinformation and information is dangerous, what is misinformation and what isn't? How can we manage that more in this time where you can access everything all at once?
Yeah. Well, look, it's tricky because the problem is you don't want to create some authority that decides what's misinformation, because then that authority will be taken over by bad actors. That's what always happens in history. Is the way I put it sometimes is you start with Bolsheviks and you get Stalinists. Like whenever you create a concentration of power that's supposed to reform the world, make things better, then bad actors will say, oh, hey, there's a center of power. I'm going to grab that. And then that's what happens, right? And so what you want to do is you want to find an overall pattern that tends to prefer good outcomes rather than some new central object that tends to prefer good outcomes. And so that's why I was talking about the idea of having coarse graining, meaning that people do things in groups instead of as individuals, because then they have an incentive to keep each other from becoming too crazy. And they also have a way to not have to be on the attention hamster wheel all the time. Do you know what I mean by hamster wheel? It's where you have a little rodent that's running on a wheel. Because that's what people on social media always remind me of, where they have to keep on posting. And it's just, it makes people a little nuts. So if you can share that, it makes things better. So the idea is to come up with ways to structure things broadly that tends to help people keep each other from getting crazy. And I do think that turning it into groups instead of individuals is a better way to do that. This is not a new idea. This is ancient. Most people who observe societies think that what keeps a society from being better instead of worse is what we call societal institutions, which is just groups of people who do exactly that. And they also, because they overlap in more complicated ways, tend to gravitate against society breaking apart into opposing large identity groups, because there's too many overlapping ones, which is what's happened on social media. Some of the writers who talked about this idea of coarse grainingness using earlier language would be Hannah Arendt and de Tocqueville looking at America, but many others, you know. And so I think that's really the right way to kind of promote better outcomes online. And better outcomes doesn't mean perfect outcomes all the time. We'll still be humans. We'll still be imperfect and even kind of crappy to one another from time to time. But the point is not to create a system that artificially amplifies our worst natures.
Yeah. And, you know, you're talking to us from Berkeley, I guess you live in, and of course, wonderful universities there. You've seen the transformation from the region, from like a place for drop in, drop out. You knew Timothy Leary and I believe smuggled him out of Esalen.
Yeah, that's true.
I want to hear that story too. I want to ask you about your thoughts about the future of education, because it's a very different world since the Berkeley and the California that you moved to. But tell us about that Timothy Leary story, because I think that's...
Oh, gosh. Well, I think younger viewers and listeners might not know who Timothy Leary was. Timothy was an extremely prominent person in the world in the 60s and 70s and beyond. He was probably the main promoter of psychedelic drugs and just a huge cultural figure, one of the most familiar people in culture. He was thrown in jail. He ran for president. president. He did all kinds of things. Anyway, there's an institution called Esalen, which is a famous retreat place on the California coast in an area called Big Sur. And it's hundreds of feet up on the cliffs above the ocean. And it has natural hot springs. So you can sit and soak in a hot spring looking out over the ocean with the full moon. And it's really one of the more amazing places I've ever seen on this planet. Anyway, they run workshops there where people go. And until recently, they were all very new agey or psychedelic workshops. And now, of course, they're tech, because tech's taken over culture. But Timothy Leary had been contracted to do one of these workshops. And he called me from Esalen and he said, I don't want to be here. I don't know why I agreed to this. I don't like doing this thing. And he said, okay, look, here's what I want you to do. There's a guy in LA who's a comedian who makes his living impersonating me. I want you to pick him up, smuggle him in the back seat of your car, and then smuggle me out in the back trunk of your car so that I can get the impersonator to take over. And I was like, aren't they going to notice? He said, no, they're all high. They won't notice. And so the thing is, I was really young. I was in my very early 20s. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll do that. And I don't think I did anything illegal, actually. But anyway, so I got the impersonator and I smuggled him into Esalen in the trunk and then smuggled Tim out. It was kind of like East Berlin in the hippie world or something.
I think you may have done the first Avatar, the groundbreaking.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting landscape, the amazing artists and thinkers who've come out of, I mean, just all of California, but particularly where you are in Berkeley and San Francisco. But now, I mean, students are coming up in a very different time. And I think, you know, we've seen so much change. We've seen, I don't want to say the death of journalism, but the death of newspapers. Society has changed and education, universe, the whole system is changing. So what are your thoughts for the future of education? And I know I'd love to like bottle you and send you out. And I'm sure some AI has scraped you, everything you've put out there. But what would you put into that? Because it's not really preparing people for a future of work, you know?
Yeah, so this is a very difficult topic right now, because on the one hand, of course, I could launch into a diatribe about all the problems with education. On the other hand, the education system in the U.S. is being very seriously challenged right now. And I don't know how long it'll take for this to be edited and aired. And I don't know what the world will look like when it is out. But at the moment, some of our major universities are being very deeply challenged and losing their grant money and having to lay off researchers. I was at a party at Stanford a couple of weeks ago, and 1 out of 10 people there had just been laid off because their federal grants were removed because there was DEI language in the grant. But they were just hard science projects. They were like neuroscience and medicine projects. And at the time that they applied for the money, the DEI language was legally required. So the people were put in a position where they never had any choice. And now suddenly the research is just cut off with no continuation and no planning. So you can say, well, that's research, not education. But these are also people who teach, you know. And so the whole thing, as much as I'd like to criticize the education system, the dismantling of it that appears to be going on in the U.S. is maybe be worse, you know? And so it's a little hard to know what to say. In principle, the digital information world we're creating ought to be able to create a new kind of education that's better. In principle, there could be something that comes out of this that is better. It's possible. But the problem with that is that I don't think there'll ever be a good education system that isn't very human-based and human-centered. And so if the idea is to cut costs as much as possible so you don't need to pay teachers, I don't think that'll be a good system. And the other issue, of course, is the loss of truth with the shutdown of traditional journalism to a significant degree and the replacement. There's still this illusion that was perhaps started in the era of the pirate parties in Europe a quarter century ago, that if there's an open internet, that means that you don't have to worry about any particular part of it being biased or anti-truth or something. But that's not accurate, because network effects cause certain hubs to essentially become all powerful, and they don't have a good business model. So they're too cheap to buy. So you can buy platforms like Twitter for not very much. And for that matter, TikTok or whatever. And so you have the major hubs that people actually use under either commercial or governmental influence, depending on whether they're American or Chinese.
And all the fact checkers are fired.
Yeah, that's right. And so in a post-fact environment, it's very hard to imagine a form of education that is useful or even meets the barest requirements, you know. So right now, I'm scared for education. But traditional education as it existed recently was already, I'm really interested in it. It's a major project. It's going to take generations to figure this out. And I'm very sad about it.
I'm sad too. And I think that we do have to value the teachers. That was the one thing that has been going down at university level, but those DEI stories, that's just outrageous. Mm-hmm. Common sense has to prevail on that. And there's so much that teachers do that's about emotional.
And by the way, there are legitimate criticisms of the DEI system. So I don't want to imply that DEI was universally wonderful, but that's a different question for those of you who are thinking, oh, he's just a DEI supporter. No. Think about this. Think about what it means to be doing important scientific work and first be required to do something and then be sanctioned for having done that thing you were just required to. Forget about whether it's even DEI. The stupidity of the way we're doing things is really, really profound. And it's not really about any particular idea within that system.
Yeah, I think we have to see beyond the labels. I mean, we are very diverse, culturally diverse. People from over 70 countries have taken part. But I didn't put DEI over participants' names. And then I was told I had to so that people could see. But I didn't change who was in it. I just put that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Do I take that down? I haven't approached about that. But no content
change. Nobody knows right now.
So I think it's really important to think about there's an emotional intelligence too in teachers. Like the facts that we learn, the information that we learn, that's not all. It's like knowing the backstories, knowing that people are coming from, what their special skills and background is. You know, an AI cannot do that. And I think there's so much of knowledge that's unspoken. And you know that coming from your music, your musical, your artistic world, about that intuitive intelligence that arises. So maybe I think it's a great expression of the intuitive intelligence, the collective spirit, the importance of the arts and the creative process, which mm-hmm. is what we're about. So in closing, I know that you've had many great mentors and collaborators over the years. And as you think about the future, we're talking about education and the importance of the arts and the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation. I guess, what are your thoughts about, you know, the beauty and wonder of the natural world? And what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Well, I think young people are overwhelmed by the attention battles of unimportant and very transient things on social media now. So young people are, and this wasn't entirely untrue for other recent generations, but it's just true beyond some sort of threshold now that seems important to me. So they'll tend to know about two pretty unimportant, uninteresting social media personalities who don't really matter, but they'll get into a conflict that generates a lot of attention, and that sort of thing will dominate them to the degree that they tend to be politically engaged in a package deal totality kind of a way. Like if you're left, you buy every left idea at once. And if you're right, you buy every right idea at once. And I so very much wish I could snap them out of that and get them to be a little more nuanced and say, well, maybe I agree with 2/3 of the left ideas, but then there's 1/3 I don't, or of right ideas. And then also in terms of knowledge of history, I'm a little concerned that the traditional teaching of history might have become a little too sclerotic or static or something. But on the other hand, what a lot of kids know is just so based on whatever somebody was saying at the time. Both the left and the right in the United States have emphases in their own tellings of history that are kind of weirdly askew and extreme and unfortunate. And it's very hard for a young person to get any kind of a balanced sense of thinking about how we got here, you know? And we have a lot of work to do. That's all I can say. My generation dove in and did the internet with this sense of urgency and self-certainty, and it'll take generations to fix now. So that's what happened.
Yeah, well, that's a hard truth. That's a really important insight. Yeah. And yeah, it's a collective process that we all have to pitch in. Thank you so much, John Lanier, for sharing your journey and vision of technology entwined with humanity. And in your words, as technology changes everything, we here have a chance to discover that by pushing tech as far as possible, we can rediscover something in ourselves that transcends technology. And I think that really goes to the core of art and the human experience. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Well, thank you so much. It's delightful to meet you both.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Jamie Lammers with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interview producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Jamie Lammers. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk, with additional production support by Sophie Garnier.
The music on this episode is by Jaron Lanier from his piano improv performance at Pioneer Works in Brooklyn in 2024.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, or podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a message. Thank you for listening.